So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Warrant Officer Peter Lake, recorded on March the 12th, 2014, at Mr. Lake's home in Oak Bay. It is interviewed by Benjamin Fast. And Mr. Lake, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, I think so.
Perfect.
Depends on what you use it for, I suppose, in a way.
Yes, well, we're going to be putting it into an archive at UVic so that we can learn a little bit more about the training and so that other people can listen to it. But you can tell us anything that you want to have put in or anything that you don't want as well.
Well, the thing is that I'm not very academically... because I never went to school until I was 10. And as I say, it must have been the most weird thing for me to go to a kindergarten. It all ties in with my life. But because my father lost all his money, my mother more or less had to farm me out.
So why don't I ask you a few questions?
Yeah.
So when were you born? What was the date that you were born?
September the 2nd, 1920.
Okay, and where were you born?
I was born in Salford in Lancashire.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the town was like then?
None at all.
No?
Because my mother and my father married at that time. And she said to my father that she wouldn't marry him unless we had servants. So that's how we came to be in Borneo. Okay. And all that. He was in the Air Force, you see, in the First World War as well. A lot of this stuff I've only learned in the years. Because actually, till 1985, I really didn't know who I was. I didn't know anything of my family's background. Because my father and mother separating. It's so difficult for me to... the only reason I found myself... My mother was my father's second wife. His first wife, he married in 1920. So Iris was 6 years older than I was in 1920, or 8 years older. Anyway, she knew I existed, but I didn't know she existed until 1985, when she eventually tracked my sister down. She was looking for me all the time, but she could never find me anywhere, because most of that time I was in Africa by then. See, I keep diverting myself. It's awful. That's why I've hesitated ever doing anything about it. Because only since 1985 and after that I've learned about all these things that happened to us. Going back to my father's family, in the 1867s, I didn't know this story until 1985 period, that my great-great-grandfather, he was a coach builder. And he must have built these very big, large coaches. On a trip with my wife, I suddenly saw Sir Francis Chichester's family home. And I thought to my wife, oh, we must go and see this. Because we went to see his yacht when he landed in Portsmouth. And so I wanted to see some history about him. And I did. And there I saw... They had a barn, about three or four barns, with all these, and one of them with these big wheels this high. And I thought, my great-great-grandfather must have built things like this. Because he lived in Hoo Hall, in Essex, Riven Hall. And on one of my trips to England, we went to visit Riven Hall. And I got photographs of it and other things. So in 17, I have record that my cousin's husband found, and it showed Benjamin Lake residing in Hoo Hall in 1730. Mm-hmm. Now, one of his great-grandchildren, his name was at that time Podmore Lake. And when he died, he willed the estate be sold up and the money be given to the British and Foreign Bible Society. And I got some record, but I've never been very good because I had a business to look after and a brain-injured son. I'd had a terrible, hard time coping with my life, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, during the war years, I didn't know any of this. But in hindsight, and then looking back, I really survived being killed at least 16 times in the war. Not from enemy action, directly, indirectly. And the very last one that happened to me was in October 1945. October 1945. Well, you can see that practically the war's over. But anyway, I finished my... Now, this goes back to why I happened to be there. I finished my first tour. I was trained on torpedo Beauforts. I'm trying to make it so it there's some chronological order to it all. But anyway, let's go back. I eventually joined because Churchill was so... He must have been frantic to know what to do. And so in September, I was with my mother by then. September 1940, and they were starting to advertise for aircrew, and as soon as I saw it, I filled it in. About that's my birthday. It was almost when I was 1940. That's when I had my 20th birthday, 1939, 1940, year 20. And by October, I went to Plymouth and was accepted for aircrew training. And I've got some of the papers all about that.
Well, that's what I want to focus on. So
that's where I'm starting to get to my Air Force. So that's when I went to Portsmouth, which was very badly bombed at that period in time. And I was accepted, and then I had to wait. Memories are beginning to fade now. January, I went up to London. Well, when I was working with L.G. Hawkins, my mother was in Cornwall. I was in Diggs in Notting Hill Gate. So when I joined up, I got a... The Air Force give you... the fare. They paid for the fare for you to join up. And so I took the train up to London and that would have been January the 12th. And that night, when I arrived in London, there was a full-blown air raid going. The guns were going, the bombs were falling, shrapnel was coming down, and I had to get from St Pancras Station, I think, to Notting Hill Gate, which is about four or five or six stations under the underground. And of course, that's when I first real effects of the war, seeing all these families on the railway platform. And the one I got out of was, strangely enough, one of the deep ones, and you came up by lift. I don't think it had escalators. And all these people, hundreds of them, on the railway platforms. Anyway, I got to Clanricarde Gardens, where the owner of the building liked young people. He was a master at Dulwich College, and he had one of his school pupils living there. I can remember him even today, him studying and making his tea with a little nice to chat with him for some of the times. And when I arrived, as I say, full-blown, guns going and everything, and shrapnel falling, as soon as I arrived at the house, knocked on the door and came in, an incendiary bomb fell. Only, you know, only 20 feet away from me, into the bedroom of the house. You know, you can imagine London houses, five stories high, and they were layers, about three or four floors above the ground floor. But if it had been a high explosive, a 500 pounder, I wouldn't be here. That's my first, should have. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, the house not far from my mother in Cornwall got a direct hit also after she left. That's just another thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went up to Uxbridge for being holding up myself and signing on the dotted line. And I was joined up as a Royal Air Force VR, Volunteer Reserve.
Mm-hmm. So what was your interest in the military as a young man?
What was my...
Your interest in the military as a young man?
None at all.
No?
No, I might have considered. You see, my father had been an observer in the First World War, and he was in the Royal Naval Air Service, first of all. And I have him in a uniform. The Royal Naval Air Force was rather an elite group. And of course, they were broken up. Eventually, they became Fleet Air Arm. But during the war, it became the Royal Flying Corps. So my father then, somehow, from being in the RNAS, he became someone in the Royal Flying Corps, and eventually, he was in the Royal Air Force by 1918, and when the war came to an end.
And did you know that he was in?
So that's the only reason I might have joined the Air Force. Probably would have done. Yeah. Because strangely enough, when my mother got me on this poultry farm, their daughter married an Air Force man, and he came and took me. He had a Bentley, fantastic car, sitting up here, and we just drove in. He probably was flight lieutenant by then, or maybe even a squadron leader, because they went to, this was 1936, they went to Khartoum, and I have two postcards from the girl, the daughter, his wife, and he took me to Hendon, And so I was interested, mm-hmm. and perhaps, but my lack of education balked me all along. When I was with them, I went to Vauxhall to see if I could be apprenticed, but my qualifications were nowhere there. Mm-hmm. My mother tried to get me into Westminster School, and they wouldn't have me. And I eventually did get into public school, what they call Truro School, and they accepted me. But I was only there for about two terms or three, and then my mother had to pull me out because she couldn't afford to pay the fees. Mm-hmm. So I was once more, and that's when I went on to the poultry farm. Mm-hmm.
So what did your mother think when you enlisted?
When
you volunteered, what did your mother think of that?
Well, I don't really remember. I think it was probably a relief that she didn't have to look after me. And I did ask her once. I said, "Mum," I think it was after the war, I said, "How on earth did you manage to cope with me being in the Air Force and flying?" She said, "I never worried. I knew you'd be all right." Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of mothers just did that, mm-hmm. hoped. But you know, the British and Foreign Bible Society, when I look back, my father and his brother, they were both in the First World War. And my father's brother, my uncle, I eventually met him. And my father's father died from TB when the children were fairly young. My father would probably be about 18 or something, 17, I don't know. And I get myself lost sometimes. But anyway, oh yes, getting back to my father-in-law. My uncle was one of the children who were sent from Dr. Bernardo's home to Canada. I believe there were 300,000 children sent out of England to Canada, South Africa, Canada, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and Southern Rhodesia. The best country of all to look after the children was Southern Rhodesia. They treated them just as their own kind. And the worst was probably Australia.
Okay.
How they treated the boys. But my father, he was fortunate. Some of the children that came to Canada, very badly treated. They were just shoved into a barn to live with the animals, literally. But my uncle wasn't. He was sent to school and they looked after him well. And he joined the Canadian Army in 1914-15. And he was badly gassed in one of the big battles. And he was an invalid after that. So my father survived the First World War. My uncle did. Mm-hmm. And then my time in the war, as I say, the first should have was when I tried to join up in London from a bomb. If it had been instead of an incendiary, a big bomb, I would have been blown to bits.
Yeah.
It was a big bomb.
Yeah. Why did you want to enlist right away?
Oh, I saw myself as being the protector. I couldn't not look after my mother and my sister. I followed the news fairly well. and I knew about the Spanish Civil War and that the German pilots were fighting there, and I had a pretty big yen against the Germans. And strangely enough, another peculiar little incident. Germans were always great travellers. It was a German who tried to take over British Borneo before the British did. But the British suddenly realised that they would not allow that to happen. And so they had the wherewithal and the power to help the British North Borneo Charter to be set in position to take over from the Sultan of Brunei. The Sultan of Brunei, that's a very interesting story there, those days. He allowed that to take place. And the British realized the importance of British North Borneo, because their connections in Hong Kong and Malaysia and that area, because of Australia as well. And funny enough, when I was about 8 or 9, an Australian man left his son to live with us for a while. He must have been in the Navy, because some of their ships used to come to Jesselton. Mm-hmm. And the other thing with flying, the Royal Navy, they called it the Navy for Hong Kong and that area, they had an aircraft carrier, HMS Hermes. And not long ago, I thought, I'll see if I can find HMS Hermes on my computer, which I did, and I got the pictures of it. Anyway, another piece of history which is unknown to me. The adjutant, and he was prison's officer as well. He was like a military man, but he was in the Air Force. And he flew fighters in France and was shot down and badly wounded. And I suppose he was badly wounded that he wasn't able to fly for maybe a year or two. Then eventually he did get back to flying, and he did his operational flying then in Italy. And he actually shot down 5 or 6 enemy aircraft. And so later on, I followed him up too. I got my son to help me do some of this sort of work. And I discovered he got a DFC from that. Mm-hmm. And I often wondered, how on earth did my father ever get a job as an accountant with the British North Borneo Company? And he was Uncle Oxley to my sister and I. My dad had a motorbike, but he had a motorbike and sidecar. And so my sister and I used to have rides in his. If we rode, then we used to go to a wonderful sea beach about 3 miles away on the coast. And all four of us would pile on a motorbike, me on the tank, my sister between my mother and father on the back. That was the way we used to travel.
Yeah.
Anyway, this Oxley man, I often wondered about, and he survived the war, of course. When now I don't know where I am again. I get lost.
So what was the first training you received?
Of course, I went on board HMS Hermes. So I was associated with flying again in my life.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And I went on board the HMS Hermes and went into the engine room. And I still remember it as being a huge, huge, like a cathedral, you know, these big engines.
Yeah.
And I suppose it was coal-fired, possibly, in those days. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another reason that Air Force would have been in my blood, as it were.
Yeah. Mm.
Hmm. Not Army, I wouldn't have.
No.
And I wouldn't, and I didn't like Navy. I was scared of the cold. I still hate the cold.
Yeah. So what was the first training that you received?
Well, then, the first training, I was accepted as pilot navigator training. Mm-hmm.
And what did you do in that training? What were you taught?
Well, I first of all, we went from Uxbridge to Babbicombe, and that's a receiving wing. And that's where we were kitted out in uniform and did a lot of PT exercises, a lot of drilling. I was there about 3 months, I suppose. And from there, I was then posted to ITW, Initial Training Wing. And all that is learning the mathematics of pilot and being a navigator. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's what happened again. I failed my examinations.
At ITW.
ITW.
Yeah.
Yes, after I'd been there about 3 or 4 weeks, I suppose, I had to do an examination. I've got the paper I failed.
Yeah.
I've got all that stuff with me still.
Yeah.
I don't know how I managed to keep it all.
What happened after you failed? Where did you go?
So then I had an interview with the interviewing officer. And I always remember his name as well. Flight Lieutenant Wright. Well, I was enough informed to know something about the aircraft, and I thought, well, there's only one thing left for me to do. I then said I'd like to go as a wireless an air gunner. I thought I would never do any good at wireless operating, so I volunteered for that. And he said, oh no, now I think I'm going to put you down as a wireless operator, air gunner. I thought about air gunner, because I knew a little bit about Defiance at that time. Defiant was a fighter that had a turret on the back. Do you remember, you know that aircraft? So I thought, well, that's the next best thing. I'd be a straight air gunner in one of these. Thank goodness I didn't.
Yeah.
So I was accepted for wireless operator training. So from from Newquay in Cornwall, ITW, I was then sent to Blackpool. And that's where I started my wireless training, Morse code. And anybody I think certain people on bow fighters and on mosquitoes, bow fighters and mosquitoes, I don't know, they wouldn't have to learn Morse code, but they might have gravitated from Morse code as a wireless operator, but many of them were pilots who failed somewhere along the line, probably on their flying training, EFTS or SFTS, advanced flying training, and that's how they became, I think they called them radio, or we have members of that. No, I don't know. Just leave it at that.
Sure.
I'm leaving, once I managed to do my Morse code, I had to pass at 8 words a minute.
Mm-hmm.
at Blackpool. And even then I was put back one class because I was a bit slow being able to interpret the didgeridoo to writing. You're doing two things. You're having to coordinate receiving something and writing it down instantly. And that takes time. And it took me a second course to get through. Finally, I then got sent to Yatesbury Flying Training School, all the intricacies of radio, all the radio equipment. The first radio equipment I learnt on was what was the equipment, I think, of Blenheim's and Hampden's and some of those early aircraft. And they were pretty antiquated radio transmitting and receiving sets. Mm-hmm. I think by that time they got the Marconi, and I learned I've forgotten my period. Oh yes, that's right. My gunnery training came after wireless training. I must remember.
What did you do in gunnery training?
Well, that's much later on.
Okay.
We did it all in 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Ridiculous. We honestly didn't know how we could hardly really learn. What I've heard about Canadians' gunners, they had a far more comprehensive training on guns. They had guns on a moving trolley affair, on possibly on moving. We didn't have any of that.
No.
Not in 1940, 41.
Mm-hmm. So were you on the ground the whole time for the training?
No. No, when you do gunnery, you are flying. You learn about the turrets, then you fly. Yeah. And for wireless operators, you do Domine was the aircraft, I think. And three or four of us would go up together and do our spell on the radio. And it wasn't very pleasant because a lot of them were terribly sick. Mm-hmm. The aircraft used to stink with people who'd been sick. And after that, I was at Yatesbury twice. First, was doing a lot of the groundwork to do with the radio sets and how to work them and so on. And then we were sent to outstations. And I and about six others, we all went to Felixstowe. And then we were working on the ground so that we understood what happened on the ground. So we got teleprinters, and we had to do work with teleprinters. And then I was very fortunate in a way, because at Felixstowe, they have these WT radio station in touch with all wireless operators of Bomber Command in England, and they had these stations all over England, some of them just dealing with OTU, learning training school for OTUs who are using wireless operators. And then others were special stations that deal with operational aircraft, especially over France and Germany. And I was on one of those. and he was in the Tortello Tower. Have you heard of the Tortello Towers? They built some in Canada.
Are they the detective?
They were built against Napoleon.
Oh, okay.
Tortello Towers were built against a possible invasion of England by by Napoleon. But they also built them in Canada for some other reason. I've got that on my computer too. Mm-hmm. Bits and pieces, bits of news that I acquired long after those days. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there I was there, and I wasn't allowed to actually go on a set. I was just there listening and following what was going on. So I knew what was happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. As a wireless operator with another wireless operator on the ground, if I flew over England, we didn't have very much like that. Nearly all my operational flying was from Benghazi, and I used to fly towards the Adriatic and towards the heel of Italy. And the Mediterranean itself, and the Aegean Sea. I flew in all those. And when I flew in the Adriatic, it depended Corfu. It was okay from Benghazi to go to Corfu. But if we had to go further north, it's been in the news, and where's my logbook? Oh, here. Misurata. We used to fly from Misurata. And strangely enough, when we left England, this is jumping forward a bit far. But when all aircrew, very often they'd meet buddies who they were with on different parts of their training. Pilots would, at maybe other stations, but later on they would meet again. And on the wireless side of it, we better skip a bit. Wireless training and doing further training on an outstation. Then we came back to Yatesbury again and continued flying training, operating radio sets, flying. And first with others, and then later on in a single plane for a single pilot and single operator. And we did that maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times. That is when we open up our logbook. So Domino. The Domino was the first aircraft I flew in. Then after the other, Pembrey.
And those are your first operational?
Yeah, a Proctor. The single engine aircraft was a Proctor. Oh, I did quite a lot on that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I did 10 flights. They're only short flights. 50 minutes, 16 minutes, an hour 25, or 1 hour. Proctor, the first Proctor flight was 35 minutes. And then 1 hour, then 1 hour 20, 1 hour 5, 1 hour 10, 1 hour 15, 50 minutes, 1 hour 10.
And that was training flights?
Yes.
Training flights? Okay.
For radio.
For radio. Okay.
Single operating radios.
And was that your sort of final training? Yes. The last?
No.
No?
No. Gunnery is my final.
Okay.
Oh no, a long way to go yet before final training. After that, I then went to Pembrey. That's gunnery school.
Okay. So you, it looks here like you did 2 of 100 rounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They also show. See, this is the result. There's the result.
Okay.
You don't make many hits.
No.
It's just on a drogue. The bullets are painted in with ink, with paint. They're painted. So when they go through the drogue is about 10 or 15 or 20 feet round. And I think they're probably about this big. They're not that big.
And you have to try to hit it.
And you have to hit that.
Yeah.
Not the pilot in the drone. Yeah. Or the aircraft towing the drone. That's Pembrey. That is in Wales.
Okay.
So from there, when you finish your gunnery, you have a choice. And you're all... There's a... Actually, gunnery school is interesting too. There's 3 lots being trained at once, about 80 in each one. Each month, a new group would come. And when we finally pass out, you have 2 in process of learning, and the ones who've accomplished their gunnery, and you get your wings then. That's the first time you have wings. Funnily enough, the wireless operator is the longest course of all. And the gunnery school only lasted 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But my wireless operator lasted 6 months or more, I would think. Pilots, if they were adaptable to flying readily, they got through pretty quickly, some of them. They just skipped through. But I was a bit longer than most, I suppose. But anyway, after gunnery, then I go to Turnberry, and this is the beginning, and we could choose which aircraft. I had a choice of being able to go on Wellington's or Beaufort's, and I happened to choose Beaufort's. My reasoning behind all that was because, that's a bit staid, just bombing people all the time. I didn't like that idea. Whereas the Beaufort is an aggressive aircraft. You hunt for shipping or to torpedo them or drop bombs on them. So I thought that's more, a bit more lively doing that. But of course I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book all on Beauforts to show you before you go.
Sure.
The casualty rates on Beauforts were horrendous. I have a register where the greatest losses of all aircraft for aircrew was Beaufort.
Yeah.
highest losses. You were almost condemned to death going on operations on Beaufort. And a lot of accidents, too. Engine failures.
Yeah, what about those accidents? Did you see accidents in training as well?
No.
No?
Funny enough, I never... See, you don't see any accidents at Wiley School. The only place is at Turnberry. And I was involved in my should-haves at Turnberry. And funny enough, because I had to get from Cornwall up to Scotland, I didn't get into the sergeant's mess until about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. That's where you crew up with your other people. Now the Beaufort is a four-man crew. Two Wallis Opera air gunners, a navigator and a pilot. My pilot and navigator were Australians. Okay. Australian air crew were by and large, were both 4 or 5 or 6 years older than the Brits. So my pilot and navigator, in fact, my navigator, he was more like my father. He seemed so old. He was about 28 when I was 21.
And you said that you had some should-haves then.
The first one was Fred Marlowe, who was on the gunnery's course. He arrived, and for some unknown reason, he chose me to be his co-wag. And so when he saw these two Australians, he plonked with them, and he says, "I've got a buddy. I'll look out for him, and he'll be in the crew with you." And so I had no choice about what pilot I would choose. As a matter of fact, I was quite pleased because they were older, partly, and because my connection with Australia during Borneo days, you see, and that sort of thing. So, in the beginning, you do some wireless operator flying and some gunnery, and you'd fly with different pilots each turn, and where is Pembrey? Logbooks are great things because I can place myself what I was doing and so and so and so and so. Turnberry. Yeah, VGO, wireless gunner. Wireless exercise. So we're doing a lot of exercises on war aeroplanes. Browning, shooting on drogues again. WT exercise, wireless operator. This is what I was doing, wireless operator exercise. Camera gun, wireless op.
And what about a near miss? What about a near miss, a should-have? Tell me about one of your should-haves in
terms. Oh, yes. Well, this is probably coming up to it now. Because all these people, when I wasn't flying with my pilot, these are all instructor pilots. Bradford. Now the next page, Crystal. Yes, this is my first flight. Oh no. my first flight with Flight Sergeant Crystal and Sergeant Johnson. So that's my pilot, Sergeant Johnson. And Johnson, WDN. And a night exercise for the pilot. Just a minute. Oh no, my first flight and my pilot's first flight. I did one exercise, wind us up, local flying, and then the next pilot I flew with was a Yeland, not my own pilot, for some reason. And then the pilot has to do his solos. The pilot must have done his night solos. He probably did it with Fred Marlowe. Because I only had one daylight flight with Johnson. And it was the finest I ever local flying. And that's when I chose to fly with Bill night solo. And so what happens is, when he does night flying, this is the first time he's done night flying, he has to take a wireless operator with him. And I volunteered to do that. And so he has he has to have a pilot, experienced pilot, and they're called instructors or station pilots. And that's when we were coming in, we'd gone up with the instructor once or twice, and then he gets out and says, okay, it's all yours now, and he leaves the aircraft just with the pilot myself. Mm-hmm. And that's when we then came in to land to do our first landing solo for Bill. And what happened was, as he was coming in to land, you see, he's got a lot to think about and worry about. The angle of approach, the height, all the revs and all the rest of it. And as we were coming in, because you have to touch your wheels, you have to actually land, run along, and then open up and take off, come round. Circuits and bumps. See, the first one with the instructor, we were up 1 hour and 40 minutes. And then the second time I flew with him, the accidents occurred in the first time. And then we both had to go up again the following night to do exactly the same, because we didn't complete our first lot, because that was when we were coming into land and the klaxon horn goes to say the wheels are down but not locked. And so he opened up the throttle and a Beaufort sleeve valve engine, and then none of them are brand new aircraft, they're all ex-operational aircraft, and his port engine spluttered before firing properly. And you can imagine, we're at 0 feet, close to stalling. Anyway, Bill made it. How he made it to this day, I'll never know. We should have gone, really. That was a very dangerous accident, occurrence, many, many aircraft had failed and crashed because of such an incident.
So did you crash on that time? No.
No. And I said to Bill, first of all, we had the hangars on our port side. We could have slewed very quickly right into those hangars. The thing is, once we got through that severe danger point of stalling, because a Beaufort is a very heavy aircraft. Behind the aerodrome, up on the hill, was Turnberry Hotel, which was then a hospital. And I did have one dream. I mean, my life still revolves around my flying. I said, I met Bill, and I said, Bill, how close were we? And he just said, 30 feet. So maybe we just missed the hospital by 30 feet. I wouldn't be at all surprised. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'd have killed all the people in that hospital. Because it's quite a big, long hospital. Petrol on board and everything. So that was my first real. And then the other one there was that because I arrived late, the first person I met coming into the mess, apart from Fred Marler, was another chap. Now, what's his name? Anyway, he was on my pilot's course. And as soon as I came in, strangely enough, he recognized me, even after maybe a year's interval. And he was looking, he was late looking for a member for his crew. And Fred Marler said, well, I'm sorry, but you're already crewed up. You can't go with your friend. So that, now he did get his crew. And I didn't fly with him, but another buddy of mine, he did. He was a member of his crew. And so this fellow had to have a second wireless operator, air gunner. And this other one said that it was his turn to do a circuits and bumps, daylight, this was for him. And Reg Faber, he said, oh, well, okay, good of you to do this. So he did it. No, the other fellow, I forget his name now, he was a famous singer, and he was always going onto the BBC for singing. And so instead of Reg Faber going, this other chap, he did that. And they took off on the short runway and I suppose had engine trouble again. They just went in, nose first into the drink off the short runway. And of course, killed and drowned. But Reg Faber didn't go on it, nor did I.
Yeah.
So one of us would have gone on that first play. Probably I would have done. I'm a great one for doing things. So that was my second should have, or third. Because that bomb, if it had blown me up to smithereens, I wouldn't have had anything else. Mm-hmm. Well, then after that, I had all kinds of funny. As the danger level goes up, the other time I should have, we were going to do an operational sortie, and we were north. We were taking off on the north-south runway. And the north-south, the north side was where 38 Squadron had their aircraft on the north end of the runway. And we were based on the south end of the runway. And so on this occasion, we took off going south. And as we took off, the starboard engine faulted. And we had a whole lot of gasoline on board. And I supposed we were still over our tent lines, because all our tent lines was in that line. And fortunately, we were close enough with the port engine strong, working. It carried us, because we wanted to do that anyway. If it had been the reverse, we couldn't have done what we did do. So we were able to land the landing ground, all those landing grounds in North Africa, from Tunisia to Cairo almost. Landing grounds, they're just sand for the fighters mostly. That's all they ever had, sand. But the heavy aircraft, we had steel interlocking, making a runway, hundreds of them. But it's only for the landing and takeoff. So we couldn't land on that. We just had to land wherever we could, even in the desert proper, if necessary. But we were able to land on the landing ground. And that was it. We ground looped, and the aircraft was left, and the blood wagon took us and put us in another aircraft, and off we went again. When that aircraft went into maintenance unit for a day or two, and then it was out in 2 days' time, and so another crew, they said, nothing wrong with it. Can't find anything wrong. And so they took it up, and it took a bit longer for that engine to cut. And they were just that much further out. And so they were too far to make a turn. So they had to crash in the desert. And of course, I'm amazed, looking back now, there wasn't an air test. If an aircraft goes into maintenance, a pilot, maybe even a ground crew may be taken up. Certain conditions, ground crew have to go up with the pilot when they've been into maintenance, and three or four guys are involved to make sure that they know what they're doing and do it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they took off, and it was an operational, because they had bags of gas on it. And that crashed and caught fire, and both the wireless operators couldn't get out, and they were burnt so badly they died. Mm. That was what would have happened to us. But we were managed to get in so quick. And I put it down to the fact that he'd already had one bad scare of an engine cutting, but this other one was the port engine cut. If it had been a port engine on this station, we'd have had it too. But it did carry the other crew on the Baltimore, they say, long enough not to be able to land. He did land all right. He didn't, but he crash landed, you know, with wheels down, I suppose, or maybe I don't know what all the circumstances. But it was a nasty scare. But then Now, our tent lines at Benghazi were at the end of this runway. And the Blenheim came in one day. Now, all of us, we were all sergeants. My pilot was still a sergeant until he'd been on the squadron a month or two. Then both my pilot and navigator, being Australians, they were commissioned. With Fred Marlowe and myself being Brits, we weren't commissioned. In fact, we didn't get any, very few of us got commissioned. And some of us, after we do a year's flying, every year you get an advancement. We were sergeants and then flight sergeants and then warrant officers. And at that point, when you're warrant officers, you may be selected by your pilot or something to be put up for commission. And I was put up for commission when I was on my Wellington much later on, mm-hmm. after we left Benghazi. Mm-hmm. Because then we made a big, big change at that point. But anyway, go forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question about what your life was like in the training. What did you do in the evenings, for example, when you were in your training? What did you do for fun?
Oh, we were able to leave camp, yeah. Yes. But we had so little money in those days.
Yeah.
We were always short of money when we were sergeants, even pilots. Never had a. They did get more money than the wireless operator and air gunners. Wireless operator, air gunners, I think we were the same pay.
So what did you like doing? What did you do?
Well, we went to the pubs mostly and eating.
Yeah.
Eating was the big thing, eating. I mean, we never had. We never had long times to be able to do anything. We never had we didn't have a holiday or a leave during training. Mm-hmm. You go through your training until you finish it. And even when I finished Yatesbury first time and I went to a ground station. I didn't have a leave at that time, so when we were at Felixstowe. Now Felixstowe was quite an interesting station because it was on the coast, narrowed. It faced the North Sea. It was bitterly cold there. I was there during the winter time, January, February, March, and I went down with bronchitis. I remember. And I remember, it's a big flying boat station, and the big hangars were huge. They were for flying boats, and the flying big hangars were within 100 yards of the river. It's the Norwich, and the river is there, and the river would be 300 or 400 yards wide, or something like that. But that's where they have 80-foot cranes, huge cranes, and they could lift these flying boats clean out of the water, putting them on. They couldn't put wheels on them. They could put them on a trolley afterwards and take them into the hangar or something like that. Mm. And we fellows who were sent there, 7 or 8 of us, as I remember. We used to have to do guard duty as well, and that was a bitter, bitter thing for us, and do other chores, and the warrant officer used to chase us up no end. We used to all say, he was a bloody bastard, that WO station warrant officer. Anyway, I ended up with bronchitis or something, because I had to do guard duty, and I look back on that period and think, the CO of that station must have been mad to put just one of us with a rifle in the dark, especially in a non-moonlit night, and you're frozen stiff in January, February in England on the coast. And the Germans knew it because they bombed. It was a pre-war station, you see. That's where the Snyder Trophy aeroplanes were as well. But the one nearest the sea got a direct hit, and it was vacant. So we actually, all the ground crew people, only used two of the barracks that we had there. Big building, two-story buildings, two-story. And had good ablutions, very good accommodation, really.
Okay.
And I seem to remember, I used to be so cold, I used to get beer bottles or any bottle that had a screw top to it and get hot water and have it in bed with me to get warm.
Yeah.
I felt the cold so badly, being in Borneo and all that.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, the little points keep cropping up as I go along,
yeah.
Memory. So yes, well, at Benghazi, just Blenheim came in, and it so happened that the wireless operator, there were two to a tent, and he was belonged to another crew member. I don't know why Flay Marlow and I weren't together, but we weren't. Oh, I know what happened. He got ear trouble, Fred Marlow did, and he had to leave me and go to Cairo for treatment. And in that point in time, I suppose that's why I had a different mate. This fellow probably wanted to leave someone else or whatever, or he was alone in a tent somewhere else. Anyway, we shared this, but he was belonged to another crew. And eventually, I got another sergeant. I went to Kew once, and I discovered that during that period, when I wasn't flying with Fred Marlow, I flew with the station wireless operator, who would boss us up, you know, give us our orders, and check up on our flying record, and then there would be a gunnery officer, a wireless officer, they would be commissioned fellows. And he must have flown with me, because when I went to Kew, I found my records of one of my flights.
Mm.
And it wasn't either Titch Wright or Fred Marlow. He was a lieutenant of flight. Probably the station wireless operator, station wireless operator.
Mm.
He probably flew with me.
That's interesting.
Anyway, I was on my own. And it was that time when another aircraft was coming into land, a Blenheim. And he was having engine trouble, I think. But anyway, he undershot and he landed. Well, there's the runway. Then the wireless operators and the air gun, the gunnery maintenance tents, all in this sort of area. And this Blenheim undershot, all our tents were in an olive grove. The olive trees were 30 or 40 feet apart, this way and that way. And one of these, this Blenheim, he had another pilot with him. He hit the deck, rolled off an olive tree at the ground level, bounced over my tent, crashed into a Baltimore on the perimeter, and caught fire. Well, we managed to get them out, because it was, we're so close, it's only 20, 30 feet away. And so if he had just come to the tree next to the one he hit, he would have taken me and my tent away too. He managed to skip over a tent. So that was a close shave. And another one, similar thing happened from England. Halifax is, seemed to be the favourite aircraft to bomb Milan or Italy. And they'd fly from England, have to climb the Pyrenees, bomb northern or middle Italy. Maybe they were bombing the naval dockyards or something. And then they would fly on, and this particular one probably had a bit of a job finding where to land, because the desert and the landing grounds blend in with the desert. And this is at night time too, 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. And they couldn't define where the landing ground starts or begins. And so they were a bit undershooting. And so I'm sure he was just a couple of feet off. And he opened up his four engines, 1900 horsepower engines, sort of. And there was a bit of a blast, and I literally jumped off the bread. So any time any bang comes, I always jump. Always, I can't help it. When I'm at the cenotaph, and I've attended many of them, and I know they're going to blast those guns, that field gun off, I still jump. And the people behind me said, "What's the matter, Lee?" I said, "I don't know. The guns. Once it's fired, I know it's going to happen." But I found it very hard to sleep. Even now, I eventually discovered how to learn to sleep and to do deep breathing. That's another funny story, because my younger son had it very hard getting to sleep, and so I played a game with him. And I said, "Look, Jeffrey, I'll see how long you can hold your breath." And I said, "I'll count 1, 2, 3. "Oh, that's good. Let's see if we can go to 7. And so on 7, he went to sleep. Oh, and incidentally, this counting on numbers business, that's one other thing aircrew had to do. All aircrew were encouraged to do swimming, but they... You've heard of Stocky Edwards? He's a very well known. He's famous, in fact. He's one of the ace fighter pilots on Kitty Hawks in the desert. And it was he who said, as a Kitty Hawk pilot or any other fighter pilot, if you manage to do 10 flights without being killed, you've got a good chance to survive." Mm-hmm. And that was what he said. But you must read his book if you can get it.
Sure.
The museum at the airport have got 2 copies, Kitty Hawk Pilot.
Okay.
Yes, I'm going on and on and on. But it's a long time I was in.
Yeah, for sure.
Six years, nearly.
Yeah. Well, I have one more question for you. Do you feel that your training adequately prepared you for the later 6 years in the Air Force?
As an air gunner, I don't think so. If I'd done Bomber Command, they treated the aircrew very differently, much more intensive. They had the means to do it. They had the personnel to do it. Mm-hmm. All their gunners were very, very much trained by other air gunners who had experiences. Mm-hmm. And they would And they had much more cooperation between each member. Much more cooperation. I had very... Well, one of the faults I have is that once my Australian pilot and navigator got their commission, we hardly ever saw them except when I flew with them. Their tents were miles away somewhere. They treated commissioned people so much better than... And I might like to tell you also a book for you to read. And it explains it very well, because he was a Canadian. And that in for a penny, in for a pound. And his... I wonder what it's... I think I might be able to put my hand on it. Now that is a book really worthwhile for you to read, because it gives you much more detailed. He was a wireless operator because he was bomber command. Mm. And the cooperation between the, funny enough, the navigator found it bothersome taking navigation shots with a sextant. So he did a lot of it for this. So that really worth your reading, if you can get it. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, you see that, Captain, that he was based on a trip he did, that's where he had to go.
Oh, yeah.
And the Italians saw him coming, driving. He volunteered to go with an army captain to go to this place for some reason. I forget the reason now. But anyway, he was shot at and a bullet went through his truck. The truck and the officer had a motor car type, a Hudson. Mm. And that's a very, very interesting. He was a Canadian. Mm-hmm. And they were in a mutiny, and he went through the whole of his operational time as a sergeant. And then eventually, when he became an instructor on wireless operating in England, and the CEO of the station put him up for a commission. But he said, "You're a Canadian. How on earth haven't your government given you a commission long, long ago?" And he said, Well, it possibly was because of that mutiny. An Australian, well, they had a bit of a nitwit British station warrant officer, station officer, station CO, or squadron CO, and he wanted to discipline these guys. And all the aircrew, all the aircrew sergeant said, "We were taught to fight a war. We don't use rifles." That's what the CO told the warrant officer, to make them parade with rifles, and when they did, they all threw their bloody rifles down. Well, they were hard. They were bombing shipping and Rommel's army, you know. Mm-hmm. It's really, really worth reading. It will tell you as much as anything about what wireless operators go through.
Sure. That's the end of my questions, or at least the formal part of my questions, but did you have anything that you wanted to add to the interview? Did you want to say anything else that you wanted to add to the interview before we end?
Oh, well, I think it was very unfortunate that that the whole crew are not all commissioned. But I felt that there's a big difference between, because now, of course, helicopters have, there's so many different people on aircraft today. The Argus that are based in Comox and all these other aircraft, big aircraft, they may have 10 or 12 people on different instruments, so that they're not necessarily need for a commission person. They're now technicians, you see. A pilot and a navigator, but especially a pilot, I mean, a pilot is still quite unique for what he has to do today, even more so than in those days. In the days, a lot of wireless operators and air gunners did get commission. I didn't get commission because of my schooling. I mean, I just couldn't have done it. I couldn't have been commissioned. I know that. I went up from commission, but as soon as they saw I didn't have school certificate or a matric or anything, and I took no courses except the radar course and the radio and the wireless course, and I got through, but that was all a struggle. And even now I have great problems running my business. And this is why I'm still... See, when I came to Canada, I could only come as an entrepreneur. And when I left Northern Rhodesia, there was nowhere I wanted to go to in Africa. So I was basically... Something happened in my wife's family's business. Her father was a qualified tailor, and his brother wasn't qualified, but they had four retail shops around Harrow and the South Coast, and I was in Amersham, and I found it very difficult being a shopkeeper, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Well, it was awful actually after being in Rhodesia, looking after 49,000 Africans and 6,000 square miles. I was lord of all I surveyed. So this question of commissions and not, but it was, I never knew what we were doing so much. Whereas with this, they were flying as a sergeant crew all the time, except the rear gunner. The rear gunner was, what was he now? I think he was Scandinavian or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was commissioned, but the pilot and all the others were all sergeants all the way through. And there were much more. They were together all the time. And they would speak up. The pilot would tell. Well, they didn't. They were very fortunate. The commissioned fellow, who was the rear gunner, he was very, very good on coordinating with his pilot. The essence of being a good gunner is to be able to estimate distance, especially at night time. You have to hold your fire. Mm-hmm. And the number one rule in being a good gunner is the pilot has to turn into the attack. So if that's the bomber and this is the fighter comes in like this, and he wants to get the rear gunner first, and then the mid upper. This is Lancaster's, Halifax, Stirling's, and the. So if they go, then the rear gunner says, go. Now what the pilot does then, he drops down and turns so that the deflection increases so much that the fighter pilot can't react quick enough. because he's just about to press the button, say, and the object goes out of his ring sight, and this fellow, I'm not sure which other, they were able to shoot down 3 night fighters through the cooperation between the pilot and the rear gunner. So the, and that is because they were all sergeants. That might never have been true if you'd had a flight lieutenant, a flight flying officers. I think a crew, all of like, and they're together all the time, is much more sure to produce a successful enterprise. But they're all facing the enemy, basically, except for the wireless operator. I think the wireless operators were rather neglected as a crew member. He was just there. He never knew what the hell was going on, except he knew he was going to be shot at. And he's quite close to the pilot, usually. On the Baltimore, this is a Baltimore. I think I can put that. It's the only aircraft that I know of that there's a window on the side where the wireless operator is, or anybody.
Mr. Lake, we can look for the photos afterwards if you'd like. We can look for that afterwards.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because I just need to finish the formal stuff, and then I'll grab the form. So thank you very much for sitting down and telling me these stories today. It's been very good to hear and learn about the training and how it impacted later on.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for doing that. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Peter Lake on March 12th, 2014. Just ask you to sign this form.
This is
the interview release form that just says that you agreed to do the interview and all that. So I will give you the pen, and if you wouldn't mind signing that, you can read it through as well. Sorry, I just need this part down here as well.
Oh, what's that?
That's just your signature down there. Yeah, so this is just your name and then your signature right there.
Yeah. My signature?
Signature, yes.
Yes. You said my name and signature.
Your name was the one you did up here.
And yes.
And then just your signature there.
Oh, but just my...
Yeah.
Well, it's more or less the same.
Perfect. And then I will do the bottom half, because I have to do the same thing. So...